This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Conversations about the distant future are good to have because they put us in a mode of hope and of aspiration for a good society.
How far into the future should we be planning when it comes to the environment? 20 years? 100 years? These are vital questions with which scientists, politicians, and futurists are grappling as our ice caps melt and our seas rise. This week on Sea Change Radio, we delve into the moral dilemma policymakers face today with Daniel Kirk Davidoff, Assistant Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Science at the University of Maryland. The starting point for our conversation is a soon-to-be-published paper comparing the timescale of methane versus CO2 emissions. We touch upon the science of these two greenhouse gases, examine how long-term environmental planning and short-term planning might conflict, and try to better understand what 100 years really means. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Daniel Kirk Davidoff. He is an adjunct associate professor of atmospheric sciences at University of Maryland. Dan, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be back.
So you're an assistant editor at Earth Systems Dynamics. It's a scientific journal. And you were editing this paper about methane release and how long we should be looking into the future with methane versus carbon dioxide and all the other variables that go into it. And you thought this could be an interesting moral discussion to have on Sea Change Radio. Why don't you first kind of lay out the basic thesis that the authors Serafim and Giordano, who are both based in Washington, D.C., one works for the EPA and the other is a fellow at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. It's entitled A Quantitative Approach to Evaluating the GWP Timescale Through Implicit Discount Rates. And so we're not going to dive into the nuts and bolts of this article.
Doesn't that sound fascinating?
It's fascinating, but there is a fascinating discussion to be had. So first, why don't you give us in a nutshell what these guys are trying to set forth in this paper?
Yeah, so they're making an argument about consistency. And this comes up all the time. If you're ever around a bunch of people who are discussing global warming, people will, you know, be batting around ideas of, are we doomed or are we going to fix it all? Or, you know, what should we do about it? And, you know, the obvious things to do about global warming is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the things that most people think of correctly is when they think about reducing greenhouse gas emissions is reducing carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels. And then sometimes people will talk about reducing methane emissions. And that makes a lot of sense because methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So you'll sometimes hear people say the most important thing we could do to reduce global warming would be to stop eating meat. And why do they say that? Well, because a lot of the meat that we eat comes from ruminants, cows and maybe sheep, and goats or other creatures that eat a lot of grain, and then they tend to burp a lot of methane out because they've got these very advanced digestive systems that can digest a lot of rough stuff with the help of bacteria that live in their guts and produce methane that goes out into the atmosphere. So when we've seen over the last century that methane has increased pretty rapidly, right along with carbon dioxide increasing rapidly, and that's because people are doing a lot more agriculture, we're raising a lot more cattle, we're growing a lot more rice, and these days, because we're doing a lot of natural gas extraction, some of which results in leakage of natural gas, which is mostly methane, into the atmosphere. So one of the reasons that people will say, well, the thing we should really do about global warming is stop eating meat, is because, as I said before, methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2. On the other hand, methane is a pretty short-lived greenhouse gas. That means there are processes in the atmosphere that take methane and oxidize it to CO2. So if you leave methane in the atmosphere long enough, it just winds up as CO2 in water. But in the meantime, while it is methane, it has this very powerful greenhouse gas effect. So then the question comes up, how should we compare the climate effect of releasing a certain amount of methane with the climate effect of releasing a certain amount of CO2? If we really only care about the next few years, then we would say that it's much more important to reduce methane than CO2. But if what we really care about is how bad global warming gets in 50 years or 100 years, then we have to think, we have to do this pretty complicated math of figuring out, well, what will be the impact of the gas we emit now, 100 years from now, and what's the relative impact of making an effort to reduce methane emissions now or to reduce carbon dioxide emissions now. And what these guys, Serafim and Giordano, are thinking about is how do we make a consistent moral decision between the way, so that the way we think about that decision about whether to put our resources into cutting methane or putting our resources into cutting CO2 is consistent with the way we generally think about how important it is to reduce greenhouse emissions.
And they're looking at this thing called the 100-year GWP, the global warming potential. What does that mean?
Yeah, so what that means is it's a way of comparing different kinds of greenhouse gases by their average impact on the radiative balance of the planet over some number of years. So sometimes you see it written down as GWP small letters 20 or GWP small numbers 100. And that means that you're talking about the average of the radiative forcing of a greenhouse gas over 100 years or over 20 years compared to the greenhouse forcing of a certain amount of carbon dioxide emitted today. A greenhouse warming potential of 1 is the same as a certain amount of CO2 emitted today. So the question is it more important to look at the near-term impact or the long-term impact? Is it a better measure of how important it is to reduce methane versus CO2 to look at a 20-year average, say, or a 100-year average, or something else entirely? The other way you can look at it is to say, well, what will be the impact on temperature 100 years from now? So that would be really heavily weighing time damage in the future versus a 20-year average, which would really heavily weight impacts in the next short amount of time, versus a 100-year average, which would weigh things out for a long time.
Now, I haven't read this whole paper, just the abstract, but I'd like to understand, the authors are not looking at solutions and different life choices that people should be making or choices that policy decisions that governments and government agencies should be making. They're just merely looking at the timescale of methane versus CO2, and then we can do what we want with it. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And they're not even, it doesn't even necessarily have to be methane. There are other greenhouse gases that are, you know, similar issues. One of the things that comes up is what we should do about aerosol pollution. So, aerosols don't last very long in the atmosphere at all. And if we clean them up, they wind up warming the planet. So then you have to weigh things like how much damage is done, how much health damage is done by the aerosols on the poor people who have to breathe them, versus how much, you know, what's the climate impact of doing that. So there are all sorts of different ways where this kind of an argument might come up. Last Sunday morning,
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Daniel Kirk-Davidoff. So, Dan, are we in for our own lifetimes with this planning, or is it more germane to be looking at our grandchildren and great-grandchildren when we're looking at something as major as transforming the Earth, which is really what we've been doing since the Industrial Revolution?
Here's the way I tend to think about it. I tend to think about the problem of global warming as being, you know, a century-scale problem. You know, we started thinking about this in a serious way in the 1980s, and back then we were thinking about, well, you know, what's going to be the climate of the planet at towards the end of the 21st century. So that's gotten like, you know, 30, 40 years closer now, but we're still thinking about, you know, what's how much of a problem is this going to be in 2080 or 2090 or 2060 even? And if we want to minimize that, well, let's use our use mathematical tools to figure out what's the most important thing we can do now that will make the problem not get too terribly bad. And those are the kind of goals that all the nations of the world got together and said in Paris, that we wouldn't let global warming exceed 2 degrees, and we'd aspire to not let global warming get past 1.5 degrees warmer than the pre-industrial climate. Now that's getting tough because we're already like 1.1 degrees warmer. So, you know, 1.5 is swiftly getting into the rearview mirror, probably in, you know, within 20 years or so.
And for our listeners, this is Celsius that we're talking about, which is actually a little bit more than we think of, right?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Alex. I should have said that. So it's a good idea to be thinking at least a little ways in the future, because that's kind of the scale of a global warming problem. If we are worrying about what's going to happen next year, well, nothing that we can do about global warming will have very much effect on the climate of next year, because, you know, we're the climate system takes at least a decade or so to adjust to anything that we do about greenhouse gas forcing. But if we want to think about what are the kinds of problems that global warming is causing now, some of the things we're going to think about have to do with rates of change. So as we increase greenhouse gases and the planet gets warmer, that might cause some ecological stress to animals that live in, you know, kind of at the edge of their range. It causes sea level to rise, and at the speed at which sea level rises causes stress to human society. We have to stay ahead of sea level rise. We have to make sure our cities are safe. We have to, you know, build extra structures to keep people safe from rising sea level, for example. So depending on how we want to balance concerns about how bad things might get for our grandkids versus things, you know, that might be bad for us or our children in 20 or so years, we have to make a lot of different decisions about how we're going to prioritize things that we can do today.
When you're trying to forecast what the world is going to look like or what the impact human inputs are going to have on nature, we can't help but overlook a lot of the feedback loops that occur. Like, we're, for example, with sea ice degradation. I remember hearing 15 years ago that this was going to be leading to X amount of sea ice degradation, but now we have more black ice and more water, and so it actually is kind of accelerating the degradation more than previously thought. So it seems like there's a lot of variables. As humans, we tend to not look 100 years in the future, almost ever. That's why this is such an interesting exercise.
Yeah, so on the positive side, the fact that we're talking about global warming at all is a real testament to forward thinking. You know, people first got an idea that this might be a problem 100 years ago, you know, in 1900 or so, when Arrhenius started thinking about the problem. And we, in the 80s, we got much more confident that, you know, we understood the basic physics of how greenhouse gases work, and started to talk pretty seriously about global warming as a problem of the coming century and something that we needed to do something serious about. We needed to really change the structure of our energy system over the next, you know, say 30, 40 years. And that's what people were talking about in the 80s, and we're in the midst of that process now. And that was the result of a really wonderful ability that our field of atmospheric science has come up with to be able to look a ways off into the future at the impacts of our actions. So that's a big gift that science has given us, the ability to know with some certainty what the results of our decisions will be 20 years in the future, 50 years in the future, 100 years in the future. And so it's important to think about that carefully. And the question is, what's the best way to do that when we're comparing decisions that we could take? Now, I think it's fair to say that one way of looking at this is that we should aim for a sustainable society. So we should figure out what a society would look like that would, you know, live within reasonable bounds of climate emissions, and then just try to get there as quickly as possible. And firing on all cylinders, you know, doing it, every approach that we can think to take that will get to each of the goals that we set for what sustainability looks like. So we might say, well, we shouldn't have methane emissions that result in concentrations going up forever. We should have methane emissions that result in some stable level being achieved. And that's fortunate because on the methane side, that's a little bit easier because it has this short lifetime. So it doesn't stay in the atmosphere forever. But CO2 stays in the atmosphere forever. So if we, or essentially forever, so if we want to have a sustainable society, we essentially have to have zero CO2 emissions because whatever we emit basically stays in the atmosphere. So you can't have stability, you can't have a long-term level climate without going right to zero. So that's one way to think about it, is to say we're going to picture what a sustainable society is, one that has, say, no net emission of CO2, and has moderate enough methane emissions that it doesn't, you know, we don't disturb our climate by too much.
And I guess the extension of my last question is, we have to kind of evaluate what is the best political system to be able to look so far in the future. I guess that's why I was thinking of these totalitarian regimes where they don't have to have high approval ratings every year. They have the luxury of being completely in charge. That's one of the conundrums we have within a democracy, is the people in charge, they need to please the people who are on Earth today. How does that square with something like looking at the timescale of methane over 100 years? Can we have our cake and eat it too as political leaders?
Your guest a few weeks ago, George Monbiot,
did a really wonderful job expressing the hopeful view that people are much more empathetic than we give ourselves credit for, that we're capable, we're very capable, and we do actions all the time that indicate that we care about other people, and we do things all the time, and we tell stories to ourselves all the time about the admirableness of planning for the future.
For example?
We tell sentimental stories about farmers who plant an acorn and, you know, are asked, well, why are you doing that? You know, you'll never see the benefit of it. Well, you know, my grandchildren will. So, and we do things like that. People are very interested in building legacies. And that's why it's possible to talk about things like a discount rate, because in theory, this is the economist way of estimating how much people care about the future, because you can measure that by what people do. You know, people don't People do save money over their lifetimes. The people who obtain wealth like to think about leaving it to their kids, or they give it away to fancy institutions that put their name in lights for the ages, right? So there's a lot of ways in which people care about the future, and for a lot of people, just getting up in the morning and making sure their kids are fed is hard. It's tough work, and we do it because we want our kids to have to grow up and have a good life. And we envision our children's future all the time. We think all the time about how we'd like them we'd like them to be happy. We'd like them to have love and have good work and live in a good society. So I think what we've suffered from maybe over the last few years is a lack of ambition among our political class to remind us of those values. And whenever we see it, we're comforted and pleased. And whenever we don't see it, we get anxious. And, we've had a lot of anxiousness lately, but I think conversations about the distant future are good to have because they put us in a mode of hope and of aspiration for a good society. And so it's maybe one of the ways in which talking about global warming has been politically successful for some people. I think I get the sense, I haven't looked at polling numbers, but I get the sense that Jerry Brown is leaving public life pretty soon as a pretty popular person, having put a lot of work into climate change. And one of the reasons that politicians are inclined to look at it at all, which sometimes seems miraculous to me, because as you say, it isn't going to matter for next, the climate isn't going to change very much before next year's election, right? But people are willing to talk about it. Politicians are sometimes willing to put energy into it because it evokes a sense of shared purpose. It's a big project that we can all work on. So, I think I'd like to think that I care about this stuff for its own benefit, that I care about what the world is going to be like. But I'm happy to have politicians think, well, if I talk about things like this, people are going to see me as someone who is a leader for the future, who will lead us in a good direction, who will encourage the best in us. And maybe that's overly optimistic, but I think some politicians have done a pretty good job with that.
If today was not a crooked highway, if tonight was not a crooked trail, if tomorrow wasn't such a long time, then lonesome would mean nothing to you at all.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Daniel Kirk Davidoff. I guess it really kind of comes down to your view of humanity. When you look at the 100-year conundrum, do you think of somebody telling you, we got 100 years of coal left in the ground, why are we worrying about solar power and those kind of things? 100 years seems like magical thinking, like that's so far down the road, that's forever, versus somebody who's looking at 100 years and thinking, we got to start planning now because we want to leave the planet better than it is right now, or we want to improve things for the future. There's wisdom and there's optimism in that. So when you read something like this quantitative approach to global warming potential 100 years from now, it actually makes you optimistic, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it does. I mean, people writing in academic journals are always picking arguments, because that's a good way to inspire yourself to write something new, is to read something that you don't like and come up with a response. And I think these guys were responding to a couple of other papers that were saying, well, really, we should be looking at both of these measures. We should be looking like a spectrum of the impacts of a gas. And they had proposed looking at the impact of methane relative to CO2, of short-lived greenhouse gases versus long-lived greenhouse gases, that you should think about it as like a blood pressure metaphor. You should think about it as looking at both the 20-year potential and 100-year potential is kind of like, well, the way we look at like a systolic and a diastolic blood pressure. So we have two pieces of information. We can think about the immediate impact and we can think about the long-term impact. And I don't think that's crazy either. I think it's the whole dialogue about this is a process of trying to balance our concern for tomorrow with our concern for 100 years from now.
Well, it's always a fascinating discussion, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Daniel Kirk Davidoff. Dan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Alex. Always great to talk to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Brian Eno, the Allman Brothers Band, and Bob Dylan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.